Hello, and welcome to Sesquicentennial Stories, a deep dive into the history of Alaska before, during, and after the Alaska Purchase in 1867. Our goal is to tell the story of the 49th state from as many viewpoints as possible, presenting you with some twists on stories you know, and hopefully learning something new along the way. This series is sponsored by the Sitka Historical Society and the Sitka History Museum. I'm Emmett Williams, and today is part one of my conversation with Dr. Lee Farrow, the author of Seward's Folly, A New Look at the Alaska Purchase. Can you talk to me a little bit about your interest in Seward? Like, where did that come from?
I'm trained as a Russian historian, and in more recent years, I began to do research in the history of Russian-American relations. So my previous book is Alexis in America, about the visit of the Russian Grand Duke Alexis to the United States in 1871 and 72. So I was already kind of on that track of looking at Russian-American relations when I took a cruise to Alaska. And as I was on the cruise, I thought, you know, I really don't know that much about the Alaska Purchase outside of kind of the general information. And so I thought, well, I should pick something up to read on this while I'm on the cruise, as it seems that everybody was reading a book about Alaska on the cruise. And when we stopped in Sitka, I went to the only little bookstore in town at the time, and I couldn't find a single thing to read on the Alaska Purchase, which surprised me. And so when I got home from that cruise, I did a little bit of poking around, and I discovered that the last book for adults that had been published on this subject was in 1975. And so I approached University of Alaska Press, and I said, I think there's an opportunity here. The anniversary is coming up, and we need something out there that people can pick up and read, especially people who are going on a cruise or traveling to Alaska and who just want some information about it. And I proposed that I be the person to write that new history of the Alaska Purchase, something that would be well-researched, but written for a general audience.
Can you talk a little bit about what Alaska was like before the purchase?
So Russia had established a presence in the territory that we now call Alaska several decades before any of this occurred, so at the end of the 18th century. And there was a small Russian presence there. It was in the form of the Russian-American Company. And they engaged in a lot of trade, especially the trapping and trading of furs. Many of the people who had moved there and were working there had eventually intermarried. So by the time, let's say, the 1850s and 60s rolled around, you had people who were already several generations in, and or a generation or two in, I guess. It was a mixed batch of people at that point, and there were people who were now being called Creoles because they were actually of mixed background. There had been some negative interaction between the Russians and the native people in Alaska. That sort of came and went, so there were some tensions there. But overall, things had been functioning fairly well. But the colony itself was, or the company itself, was not hugely profitable, and it was very difficult for Russia, so far away, to oversee that colony, to feel confident that it could defend that colony in the case of a crisis. And that was one of the things that ultimately led for several people within the Russian government to begin to look at the possibility of selling it.
Also, what I found interesting is the area that we now call British Columbia played a huge role in defining what became America and what became Canada.
And that was something I didn't know that much about when I started this research. All across British North America, especially along like the border areas, there were annexationist movements at various points where, you know, people on the Canadian side or the British North American side thought that perhaps they'd be better served by being part of the United States. And so there were people who advocated annexation by the United States. There were certainly people in the United States who, in the spirit of manifest destiny, thought that there might be a possibility of absorbing parts of British North America. And in BC, there was a particularly strong climate there of uncertainty. BC was not faring well at various points under British rule, and it was very far away, of course. And so there were quite a number of people there who thought that perhaps it would be best to just become part of the United States. And, of course, politicians in the U.S., people who favored that idea, sort of seized on that, the popularity of that in D.C. and saw that there might actually be a chance that we could absorb that. And that, so that was a very real discussion, and so it was a very real fear on the part of anyone who favored the idea of a federation in British North America, that we might actually prey upon the weakness of that situation and try and take British Columbia to be our own.
The purchase of Alaska really started ramping up in the 1850s. And can you talk a little bit about why the purchase took so long?
So, yeah, so, I mean, the first sort of, you know, serious conversations that began about the exchange of territory began in the Crimean War. So, you know, on the Russian side, there were people who recognized the dangerous situation there, that the Russian colony there was very vulnerable. It was so far away, it would be very difficult for Russia to defend it. There was a really serious fear that Great Britain might just seize it during the Crimean War. And so there was actually a conversation and an attempt at kind of a fake sale where there was a conversation that maybe Russia could pretend to sell it to a group of merchants in San Francisco as a way of getting it out of the way so that Great Britain couldn't seize it. But before that ever went anywhere, Great Britain went ahead and declared that Alaska would not be part of the Crimean War, that it was sort of off limits. And so that kind of put that on the back burner temporarily. But there was continuing conversation on both sides. So people in the United States sort of had their interest piqued by this opportunity. And they continued to think about Alaska as something that might be territory that we gained. And there are several quotes I have in the book from politicians, including Seward, who said things that implied that, you know, this territory would eventually be ours. And on the Russian side, there were conversations as well, including from the Tsar's own brother, Constantine, who advocated sale, who believed that the territory was too remote, it was too difficult to monitor, too difficult to protect, and also it wasn't incredibly profitable. And Russia was interested in expanding in the east, in Asia, and so this was a drain on their resources. With the end of the Crimean War also highlighted a lot of Russia's weaknesses, especially within its military. And so there was, again, sort of another reason to think about maybe shrinking getting rid of some of those extra pieces of the empire that weren't working out and concentrating their money and their resources in other places. Ultimately, though, as you mentioned, I mean, by the time the 1860s rolled around, the early 1860s, the United States, erupted in civil war. And so any kind of conversations that might have been beginning at that point had to be put on a back burner. And so it wasn't until after the end of the civil war that this kind of idea could be resurrected.
Right. And even then there was, so Johnson seems to have been distracted by the reconstruction.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah, Johnson, I mean, we were under the process of reconstruction here in the South, and Congress was at odds with Johnson over some of his actions in the South, so his sort of heavy-handed approach to executing some changes here in the South. And so there was a lot of tension. And actually, this was something like I didn't know that much about until I read more. The actual impeachment of Johnson was happening at the same time that politicians were debating the appropriation bill to pay for Alaska.
You're listening to Sesquicentennial Stories, a production of the Sitka Historical Society and the Sitka History Museum. I'm Emmett Williams, and I'm talking to Dr. Lee Farrow about the Alaska Purchase, and I asked her about Alaska Native life before and during the transfer.
There were some previous tensions between Russians and Native Alaskans there, especially the Tlingit tribe. And so, the relationship had been sort of a semi-peaceful coexistence. I mean, there were flare-ups occasionally, but by and large, they tended to work okay together. But there were a lot of concerns with this. So, many Native Americans, Native Alaskans, when they found out about the sale, did not see it as a legitimate thing because they considered the land to be theirs. So the idea that one government could sell it to another government simply didn't make sense to them. It wasn't right because it wasn't anyone's land to sell in the first place. So that was one thing. In addition to that, as you mentioned, a lot of intermarriage had occurred over the years. So at the time of the purchase, there was a rather large group of people who were the product of mixed relationships, mixed marriages in some cases, and that made it very difficult to sort out who was who and to speak of any kind of clear delineation between people who were solely Russian and solely Alaska Native. Some of this became apparent in the U.S. government's attempts after the purchase to try and kind of get a hold on the situation there, to sort of get an assessment of what they were, what they had bought. So there were these sort of like population kind of census records where they went through and like listed all the people in the town of Sitka, for example, and tried to characterize them by their profession and their native status. And there were obviously a number of people who were of mixed birth in that. There were also some complications, and this has less to do with, I think, the Native American part, but it does somewhat, where, you know, after we purchased it and we had transferred the property in October, defining what was actually property that belonged to the company and what was property that should be public property or private property. And the Russian American company had a habit of allowing its employees to live in housing which the company had built. And so they sort of had usufruct of that property, but that property passed from generation to generation. So houses would go down from a father to a son, for example, even though it was technically company housing. Well, then when it came time to make a decision about what was private property and what was company property, that was very difficult. And you had people living in those homes who were of mixed families, of mixed background. So that, you know, it was all very difficult to sort out who was who and who should have what when all this came down to it at the end.
And is it true that the population really dwindled, and it wasn't until the gold rush that people started really paying attention to and populating Alaska?
Yeah, the early years were really rough for Alaska. As I said, you know, the first people who kind of moved there were these people who were opportunists and adventurers, you know, a lot of single men looking to go up there and make a lot of money very quickly. And so there weren't, like, a lot of families going up there at first. It was really hard to get people like that to move up there because the conditions were harsh. And, you know, the, like, mail service was very slow and unreliable, and other kinds of things like that were still not yet well established. So it was very hard to recruit people who to go up there and like set up homes and bring their families, and difficult to find teachers, difficult to find people to work in the churches that were being established, simply because the conditions were so harsh, and not even just the weather, just the remoteness of it, the distances involved made it difficult to live up there, and so it was hard to get people up there. And so people would come and stay for a while, and then if they didn't make it big, they would leave because it was simply too much. So it took a while for sort of serious settlements to build there with the kind of, you know, infrastructure and diversity of people that, you know, you would want to have to start a new colony or a new state.
You've been listening to Sesquicentennial Stories with Dr. Lee Farrow. On part two, we'll talk about some of the myths that she was able to debunk about the Alaska Purchase and how the transfer affected Native life. This series is sponsored by the Sitka History Museum and the Sitka Historical Society, with support from the Rasmussen Foundation, the Sitka Legacy Fund, and KCAW Sitka. This series is produced by Mission Man Media. Jeff Budd is the executive producer. I'm Emmett Williams, and thanks for listening.